Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. And today we are speaking with the author of a publication that appears in the February 2019 issue of Anesthesiology. With us is Dr. Daniel I. Sessler. Dr. Sessler is the senior author of an article titled, Triple Low Alerts Do Not Reduce Mortality, a Real-Time Randomized Trial. Dr. Sessler is a professor in the Department of Outcomes Research at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome, Dr. Sessler.
Thank you.
So what was your primary goal or aim in doing this study?
We sought to determine whether intervening for triple low events would reduce mortality.
Okay, so tell us what a triple low event is, or how you define triple low events.
Triple low events are the simultaneous combination of mean arterial pressure less than 75 millimeters of mercury, bispectral index less than 45, and volatile anesthetic MAC fraction less than 0.8.
So right off the top of my head, these numbers don't seem like sort of typical triggers that I think the average anesthesiologist would be terribly concerned about. Is it the combination of all three of these that you think are important?
That's exactly right. Individually, none of these is an important threshold, and individually, none of them is linked to mortality. But combined, they are. So combination of any two, and especially all three together, is a strong predictor for postoperative mortality.
So you touched a little bit on this. Can you give us more details about what we know about these triple low events and specifically outcomes before you did this study?
There have been several previous studies showing that the combination of all three of these events, which we term a triple low, predicts 30-day and 90-day mortality after surgery. Reasonable question is why that should be. These events appear to be prognostic because they are identifying patients at risk. So consider a patient who has a high bispectral index, who's not very anesthetized, but has a low blood pressure. This is not a normal combination. You're identifying a patient who is fragile. Similarly, a patient who has a low MAC fraction should have a high bispectral index. But if the patient has a low bispectral index, that would indicate a patient who's excessively sensitive to volatile anesthetics. So these combinations identify patients who are fragile, who are susceptible, and therefore it's perhaps unsurprising that they have high mortality after surgery.
So I guess I could rephrase it. You're talking about a patient who doesn't require much anesthesia, but ends up with a low BIS and a low blood pressure.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That's an unusual combination. It's a
Correct.
Combination that identifies a patient as being particularly sensitive to anesthesia. Well, patients who are sensitive to anesthesia are fragile. They're probably not in very good health to start with. And consequently, it's unsurprising that they don't tolerate surgery well and end up having high mortality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question that triple low events are prognostic. This has been shown now in two different studies. Double lows, that is any two low events, or especially the combination of three low events, predicts mortality. The question we asked is whether intervening prevents this increase in mortality. And
mm-hmm.
that's not obvious. Those are different events. You could have a situation where triple low events are prognostic, but they are not themselves causal. That would happen if triple O events simply detect fragile patients, but the triple O events themselves are not harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But our theory was that the triple O events themselves are harmful, and therefore that intervening to prevent them would reduce mortality. That mm-hmm. was the purpose of the study, and that's what was different about this study versus the previous ones, which were observational.
Mm-hmm. And a very important question, because I guess, you know, it's one thing to say they're associated. It's another thing to say the cause and effect truly.
Exactly. Lots of things are mm-hmm. associated mm-hmm. that are not causal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, associations can still be useful. They're prognostic. They tell you what's going to happen. They allow you to predict this patient is more likely to get into trouble, and maybe you use that to tell patients or their families that this is a high-risk mm-hmm. situation, or you try to admit patients to an ICU and try to moderate the expected increase in mortality. But it's different to say that an event is actually causal, because mm-hmm. then you could intervene and prevent the harm.
So can you postulate on what perhaps is the pathophysiologic mechanisms that account? I mean, are these cardiovascular deaths, or do we know why these patients with this association die?
We don't specifically know why patients with triple O events die, but we do know that myocardial injury is the leading cause of 30-day mortality after surgery. So it's likely that myocardial events contribute.
Well, especially with the hemodynamic changes that we're talking about. So what kind of a study was this? Was this a randomized prospective trial or some other design?
This was a randomized control trial. So patients with triple O events were identified and then randomized to either an alert or not. So this is an important distinction from a conventional trial. Conventionally, qualifying patients would be approached, consented, and then assigned to one treatment protocol or another. The difficulty with that approach here is that most patients having surgery don't have triple O events. So we would have to consent an enormous number of patients to identify some who have triple O events. Furthermore, we needed an enormous number of patients for this study. Our sample size ended up being about 7,500 patients with triple O events. You need that kind of sample size if your outcome is mortality, which fortunately is relatively rare after anesthesia. So we used a different approach. We got a waiver of consent from our IRB, and then we screened patients electronically. To be enrolled in the study, patients had to have bispectral index monitoring and had to get a volatile anesthetic. That put them into screening for the study. And then our decision support system evaluated patients at one-minute intervals looking for triple O events. When a triple O event was identified, the system on the fly instantly randomized patients to either no change at all, nothing happened, or to generate an alert that went to the providers. The alert said, this patient is having a triple O event, consider hypoperfusion. The providers were then free to respond or not respond as they considered appropriate.
Interesting. So what kind of alert did the providers get? This was something that popped up on their EMR or a page or?
It was both, actually. The alert was provided on the electronic medical record screen, and both the clinician in the room, typically a resident or a CRNA, and the attending anesthesiologist were both paged.
Interesting. And did they have to activate the EMR to say okay, to acknowledge the alert?
They eventually had to acknowledge the alert on the EMR, but they didn't have to do anything about it.
Right, right. And you guys didn't guide them on what to do. You didn't make suggestions or anything. They were left a bit at their discretion to either treat or not treat.
Well, on an individual basis, no. But we did have department meetings about this. So the clinicians did know the theory of triple low. They knew that triple low events were prognostic for death, and they were aware of our recommendation that patients be treated. Mm-hmm. And the treatments that we considered most helpful would be to give a vasopressor, which would quickly increase the blood pressure, or to decrease the volatile anesthetic. Mm-hmm. Decreasing the volatile anesthetic would also increase the blood pressure and increase the bispectral index.
Is this alert system a standard part of your EMR, or is it a specialized tool that you had to build?
It was a tool that we built specifically for this study.
And how could you tell if the providers responded to the alerts? I mean, I guess if they said okay, then you knew they acknowledged seeing it, but was there a time period if they changed the anesthetic or delivered that you utilized as saying this was in response to this alert?
Yes, and our criteria for response was either a vasopressor given within 5 minutes or a 20% decrease in the volatile anesthetic administration within 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't go by whether they acknowledged the alert, because that doesn't tell us whether they did anything about
right.
it. What we wanted to know was whether they did something functional, and we used those two criteria for defining what we consider to be a useful response to a triple O event.
So I guess you defined the change in the volatile agent by a percentage, but was it considered an appropriate response if the provider just actually gave any amount of vasopressor, or did they have to prove, or did you look for correction of the blood pressure to some degree?
We used any vasopressor administration as one of the criterion for an effective response. But yes, we also looked at how long the triple O events last, which is basically how long it took before something improved, the bispectral index increased, MAC fraction increased, or the blood pressure increased.
So I know you defined the triple low at the beginning, but I guess for our listeners now that we've talked about all of this kind of process and methods, can you tell us again what these levels were? What were the levels of volatile agents, blood pressure, that you were defining as triple low?
Okay. Triple low events are defined by mean arterial pressure less than 75 millimeters of mercury, bispectral index less than 45, and MAC fraction less than 0.8.
Got it. Okay. So now tell us a bit about the population of these patients. Like, kind of, I guess, did you take all types of surgery, ambulatory, would there be major surgeries? What, on average, were ASA physical status scores of your patients? And kind of the overall predicted risk, I guess. Are we talking about a higher risk population, the 7,500 patients, or whole spectrum?
This was essentially the whole spectrum, because the enrollment criteria were bispectral index monitoring and a volatile anesthetic. It had to be adults and non-cardiac surgery. And that was about it for enrollment criteria. So this was a pretty good cross-section of the Cleveland Clinic non-cardiac surgical population. Now, of course, we're a tertiary center. Our patients are relatively sick. So very good fraction are ASA 3 and 4, most of them, in fact.
So I think earlier you mentioned about how these events are associated with mortality. Is that all you measured was mortality, or were there other outcomes that you measured? And what was the time? Was it 30-day mortality or a different timeline?
The primary outcome was 90-day mortality. But we also evaluated 30-day mortality and one-year mortality.
But not MINS or acute kidney injury, just mortality?
We did not evaluate myocardial injury or kidney injury in the study.
Pretty definitive outcome, right? If the patient is dead, you can't quibble much about that.
Well, it has the advantage of being a hard outcome.
Right.
Not subject to bias or measurement
usually.
Error. you're pretty sure about it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's not very sensitive, and I think that's what you're getting to.
Right.
That had we looked at more sensitive outcomes, we might have seen benefit that we missed in this study.
Mm-hmm. Now, your bar was pretty high. You were looking at significant poor outcome. So how common were the triple low events in this study? The 7,500 patients, I guess you can either give us a number or a percentage.
Yes. We screened more than 36,000 patients to identify more than 7,500.
Ah, I'm sorry. I misunderstood that. 7,500 were the ones who had the triple low.
Yes.
Got
it. To get 7,500 triple low patients, we screened 36,000 patients. You can see that this would be absolutely impossible to do as a conventional
mm-hmm.
trial.
You mm-hmm.
cannot possibly individually get consent from 36,000 patients. So this study was only possible because of this electronic real-time randomization,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is a unique, novel study design. This is something that's not been done previously.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, because I think we kind of glossed over it, or I did at first, with some of the other interesting questions that your discussion was raising. But that is very, and the fact that also that IRB allowed you to waive consent. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
I would love to. The basic problem is that the highest level of clinical evidence in medicine is randomized trials. But randomized trials are expensive, and they take a long time to do. There will never remotely be enough clinical trials to answer all the questions we have. Especially, there won't be really large randomized trials. The number of randomized trials with thousands of patients per group is just tiny. We get a couple of these each year, but we have thousands of important questions. So it's actually really important to develop novel trial methods that allow us to do studies that are quicker, easier, and much less expensive than a conventional trial. This is one that we've developed, and I think it's a powerful tool. It depends critically on getting waived consent from the IRB. But it turns out that there are national rules. There's actually federal law that describes when waived consent is allowed. All research needs to be approved by the IRB, but the IRB has the authority to waive consent when it's appropriate. And the rules include that this cannot be for FDA registration. You would never do this for a novel drug, for example. You're supposed to get waived consent only if conventional consent is impractical. Now, what impractical is defined differently by different IRBs, but I think most would agree that getting consent from 36,500 patients doesn't qualify as practical. This
mm-hmm.
study never would have happened had we been required to get consent from more than 36,000 patients. It just would not be possible. So it certainly met that criteria. And then it has to be minimal risk. And that's why we have this fairly unusual study design, because ideally you would have a defined protocol. So had it been up to me to design this in a world without constraints, I probably would have said, you have a triple O event, you have to give a vasopressor. That's the protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes less than minimal risk because some of the patients getting a vasopressor might not be appropriate for this.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave that authority back to the clinicians. All we did was provide an alert that said, your patient is having a triple low event. Clinicians could respond or not as they felt appropriate. And because clinicians were involved, and because clinicians presumably only did things they thought were good for their patients, the IRB, I think very appropriately, concluded that risk was minimal.
Yes, because I guess it came down to the usual care, right? Those anesthesiologists were allowed to do usual care.
Exactly. So right. An alert is not going to hurt patients.
Mm-hmm.
Alert could hurt patients if people read the alert and did something stupid, but we presume our clinicians are excellent here. They get the alert. They will process the alert. They will have more information than they did before. Now, technically, they can look at the monitors and figure out themselves whether a patient's having a triple low event. But it takes a tremendous amount of mental energy to do this every minute through the whole case, so most people probably don't. So the alerts gave them new information, and they could act on it as they believed appropriate.
I mean, it's not dissimilar to an alarm, right? The alarm goes off and...
Oh, it is an alarm.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. That is a very interesting component of this study.
It is indeed an interesting part of the study, and it's almost as interesting as the study itself, because this is a methodology that we in the anesthesia community should start using more often. We have the luxury of now having ubiquitous electronic records. There is some effort involved, but electronic records can be set up to look for various events, generate alarms, and perhaps improve care. A corollary of that is that many electronic records have various alarms inserted into them just because people think it sounds logical. My theory is that alarms should be treated like drugs and devices and should be tested formally, because many of them will not turn out to be helpful, and the ones that aren't helpful actually could be harmful in that they distract clinicians. So I think all alarms and alerts should go through a formal testing process, and this is exactly how you would do it. You would randomize patients to either generate an alert or not, and then see if you improve at least a mediator, if not an outcome.
Yeah, I like to say that the electronic medical record, I believe, is the most important piece of medical equipment that we use that is not FDA regulated.
Yeah.
I think there should be perhaps more oversight into these electronic records. So you must be familiar, many of our listeners who use these electronic records, of these things called BPAs, right? Best practice alerts. Something pops up and tells you or warns you or advises you to perhaps do something or that there's some issue. And I think that's another analogy to describe what these alerts were kind of like.
Yes.
So can you want to tell us what you found specifically around the mortality? Did you find there was a mortality difference in those who got the alerts or did not get the alerts?
There was no difference in mortality.
So even though there was no difference in mortality between those two populations, were you able to show that the providers who received the alerts were more likely to alter their anesthetics or administer vasopressors than the ones who did not get the alerts?
Providers who got the alerts were significantly more likely to give a vasopressor, significantly more likely to decrease the anesthetic concentration, but not by a clinically important amount. The difference in providers who made what we consider a useful response was only about 5%. So the clinicians largely ignored the alerts. Or more generously, they considered the alerts and decided that their patients did not warrant intervention.
So I guess you would say that they did not adequately or appropriately respond.
Well, I don't want to quite say didn't respond appropriately. Presumably, clinicians were doing what they thought was best for their patients. And our clinicians are highly skilled, so I don't want to second guess them. But for whatever reason, the alerts did not make any important change in behavior, which means that the study poorly tested our hypothesis.
You know, it struck me a bit that map of 75. I know, you know, there's a lot of debate, right? And you've published so much information on this, you know, what is an appropriate blood pressure or what blood pressure levels are associated with, you know, adverse events. And we used to talk about, you know, percentage of baseline, but then you published, I believe, data that suggested that one could just use a map of 65. Anything below that, and the longer they were below that, the higher the risk of adverse outcomes. And I've, over time, come to think that for my healthy patients, I'm usually okay with 65. And for my advanced aged or patients with vascular risk factors or risk factors for, you know, kidney injury or underlying vascular disease or kidney disease, I usually aim for a MAP of 70. I don't usually think of 75 as being too low. Do you think that has something to do with this?
Absolutely, because many of the blood pressure studies were done in our department at the same time. We're quite aware of the 65 millimeter mean arterial pressure threshold. And as we said in the beginning, 75 is high. By itself, it's not concerning. It's only concerning when you have a mean arterial pressure of 75 combined with other factors. That's when you begin to get alarmed. But I can understand clinicians looking at a mean arterial pressure of 75 and saying, that's okay, because by itself, it is okay.
But what if it didn't somehow sort of also allow them to think differently about those other values as well? I don't know, you know. Because it is interesting that they, as you said, very experienced, you know, good clinicians who work with sick patients would choose to have a certain response to something that was warning them needed adjustments.
Yes. The study would have been easier to interpret if people had responded more aggressively to the alerts. Nonetheless, about half of the patients had what we would term effective responses, and about half didn't. It was about the same in the alert and the no alert groups. But nonetheless, we got to the end of the study. We had 7,500 patients who had triple O events. About half had either a vasopressor within 5 minutes or a 20% decrease in volatile anesthetic concentration within 15 minutes. So these are effective responses to triple O events. There was no improvement in outcome in the ones who had effective responses. Even though it didn't distribute by group as we had hoped, in fact, half the patients had effective responses, half did not, and the outcomes were exactly the same. So we conclude from this that triple O events are not causally related to mortality, even though they are prognostically related to mortality.
So as most good studies, it raised questions, more questions.
Indeed.
So was there a decrement in response as time progressed? Like, did these providers get alarm fatigue?
We did not assess that, so I can't answer that question. We have these data, but I don't know.
Did you think the providers know they were being studied?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had multiple department meetings about this, substantial effort on my part to encourage people to make what I consider to be useful responses. So, yes, they were perfectly aware of this. And, of course, they were getting pager alerts in half of the cases.
And you didn't have to get IRB approval or consent for them. They didn't have to give consent to be part of the study.
No. We did not have to get consent from the providers.
So if I may summarize, I think your study showed that real-time alerts to these triple O events did not reduce 90-day mortality. And there was no difference between the responses of the providers who were getting these alerts and those who did not get the alerts. And providers largely either ignored the alerts or perhaps didn't respond the way you would perhaps have anticipated they would. So, you know, in this study, I guess it didn't matter whether they did or didn't. As you said, the outcomes were no different. But if we did want to change behavior of providers, this wouldn't have done that. Do you have any insight from this study as to how we do change behaviors of providers?
One thing I've learned from this is that we need to have better buy-in from clinicians for this sort of study. Members of the department need to feel that this is their study, that they're engaged, that they think the hypothesis is important, that the intervention is likely to be helpful and therefore will intervene when alerted to particular conditions.
Do you have any advice for the average anesthesia provider today? Do they do anything differently based on what you have found from this study?
Our results were negative. So triple O events, while prognostic, are not causal, and therefore I would not recommend any particular intervention for triple O events. So based on this study, no, I don't think clinicians need to change their behavior. There is one thing that clinicians should be aware of, and that's hypotension. It's not coming out of this study, but you mentioned our work about hypotension and myocardial injury, acute kidney injury, and death. There are very strong associations between hypotension and serious outcomes. A good threshold to keep in mind is a mean arterial pressure of 65 millimeters of mercury. That doesn't mean that if you go a few millimeters below that for a couple of minutes that a patient is going to have a heart attack. Not at all. But if you go much below that and you stay there for a long time, your patient's risk of injury goes up. I'm very worried about blood pressure.
Yes, you know, I think when many of us have, and especially in the past, you know, we were sort of upset at cardiologists when they would make recommendations to avoid hypoxia and hypotension. You know, we would feel like they were telling us something that we already knew. But I don't know that they weren't right about warning us to avoid hypotension. I think we still need to do that.
The cardiologists were right.
Yes.
Both hypoxia and hypotension are bad. Let me reframe that, though. A question is, why, after 150 years of anesthesia, we're just now figuring out what blood pressure is harmful? And it's not just because we didn't think of it. There actually is a reason. And the reason is that you need very large, accurate data sets that we just didn't have with paper records. Mm. It wasn't until the advent of electronic records, especially records like ours, which have unmodifiable blood pressures on them, where we could collect the tens of thousands of patients necessary to accurately evaluate rare but very serious outcomes. Now that we have that, it's becoming clear what pressures are harmful and just how harmful hypotension really is. It's really frightening because all of us, I think, grew up doing deliberate hypotension to levels that almost surely were harmful in some patients.
And sometimes perhaps not deliberate hypotension, but I think that's the other thing I've been, you know, a little bit shocked at is the amount of hypotension these electronic records have sort of, you know, elucidated. How frequent, how often, and for how long sometimes patients are hypotensive.
Exactly. Intraoperative hypotension is common, profound, and prolonged.
So I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you so much, Dr. Susser, for discussing your work with us today. And I wish you well as you continue your Herculean efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
Thank you much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.